Ladies and gentlemen, clerk will please call the case.
May it please the court, I'm James Erasio for the respondent, mother of the natural child. And the court has, I'm sure, has read all the briefs. And let me just first say it's a real honor and privilege to be here. It's rare that I come this way. And I must say I was floored when I received the notice that the writ had been accepted. I mean, it really was. And I think we began this case with realization that my client was a homeless or houseless mother in Hilo, and someone must have tipped off the department, regardless, or somehow they got wind that this mother and her child were in need of services from the department, and they found the baby to be dirty and mother to not have a place to live. And I think I must say those in my generation can already see the situation is getting worse in this state. And we're going to have to adopt standards to not immediately jump into a situation where the mere fact that someone may not have a home does not equate to being a mother or a parent who's not a good parent. And we're going to have to give more leeway to those individuals out there who are struggling to make ends meet. And society is going to have to bend a bit and realize that some children are going to be dirty. Some are going to need help. That doesn't mean they can't be a good parent with intervention by the system. at any rate, she gets a hearing, and I think what troubles me throughout this case is that my brother and sister attorneys out there found her difficult to work with, argumentative, in some cases not wanting to cooperate. We've gone at it myself, to be honest, on the telephone and in person. And I think, but if you take a step back, at least I realize that this is a woman who was in fear, didn't trust the system, really wanted her child back, really loved her child. The trial judge noted that this is a mother who loves her child. And then the simple question is, well, why can't we make things work? Why can't we fix this so that she can take advantage of the services offered, that she can make some adjustments, maybe get on medication, which she is on now. And she's now found a home, and she's been in the same home now since I met her in Pepequel. And I think from what I can see or hear, she's kind of stabilized. And at this point now, of course, she's lost her child. What troubles me in this case, to make a point, the day I got this notice, just by chance, I happened to be in federal court that morning in Sacramento. The Honorable John Mendez was presiding over a host of motions to withdraw, myself included, in a civil case. And I just thought these are routinely granted, but not with this judge. He called us in for hearings, and ahead of me was three or four other lawyers who wanted out. And even in the civil case, Judge Mendez said, you know, if you have trouble communicating with your client, you know, they're not paying their bills, you know, they're difficult to work with, sometimes you know, you argue with them. This is the life that we choose as lawyers. We have to try to sit down with our clients and try to make some kind of middle ground here. And and he was right. By the time we get to my case, you know, he wouldn't grant the motion. It gave me time to refile. But before I even got there, I realized, you know, that's the life we pick as lawyers, that it's going to be hard, but these people need help. We've got to bend. We've got to check our ego outside the courtroom and try to make them realize we're trying to help them.
Mr. Rizzo,
yes.
The DHS says that you failed to set forth meritorious defense, assuming that ineffective assistance of counsel applies. What's your response to that?
Well, there was definitely ineffective assistance of counsel. Some of it was counsel's fault. Some of it was the trial court's fault in handing the case over to her late, to the last attorney of record late. By the time she gets the case and she told me that the appeal was running, she wasn't aware of it, she picks up the file, and lo and behold, 30 days has lapsed. The trial court, I believe they have the power to extend the appeal period 30 days, probably sua sponte they can do that. And maybe that's what should have been done. But going back to my earlier point, Your Honor, I'm not sure if I answered your question or not, but I think if you read the arguments of the state, many times my client attorneys were on standby basis. Now, standby basis, you know, I don't know why they're even there at that point. If you're going to be standing by, you better talk to your client and intervene, because this is cross-examination. And there's not too many laypersons I know can effectively cross-examine, bring out all the truth, bring out all the facts. But they're standing there nevertheless. And that doesn't do anything, because if you don't have a lawyer, odds are you're going to lose. That's what it is. You're going to lose, and that's what happened to her. The record is full, overflowing with positive facts for the state.
Did she ask to be there representing herself when standby counsel was appointed?
She probably did, Judge. She probably did. But that does not make it right.
It may not make it right, but when a client or petitioner in this case refuses to have an attorney represent her, the court does its best and appoints standby counsel. That's happened time and time again when the party believes that he or she can do a better job or as good a job. And this is what the court tries to do to help, standby counsel.
I admit that, Your Honor, and I realize that there's only so much a trial judge can do, but I'm just saying we should be much more cautious and try to get the client and the attorney to work together. Because, you know, this woman with some mental impairments, mistrust of the system, you know, I realize that judges have only so much time.
Mr. Arrillo, at the time,
that's correct.
Right. At the time that Ms. Yoni, was it Yoni Mori, represented petitioner in this case, she was regular counsel, wasn't she?
She was.
So she wasn't standby counsel.
She was not standby. She picked up the file.
And as the ICA indicated, she was ineffective because she failed to file, a motion for reconsideration, which would have allowed her to file an appeal.
That's correct.
So we're not talking about all the other attorneys, some of whom represented her, some of whom were standby counsel in this case.
I admit that, Your Honor. We're talking about my last sister who failed to file the appeal on time, failed to realize the clock was ticking.
Anyone disagree that that's ineffective assistance of counsel when you fail to meet the deadline for filing an appeal?
I cannot speak for the state, but I think they'd agree that.
Well, in their response to your application, do they dispute that?
I don't read that as being challenged.
Now, Mr. Arrillo, when you brought your motion in February of 2007, after you came to the case, you filed it as a motion for a new trial, reconsider, amend judgment. At that time, although you raised issues of ineffectiveness, you didn't identify what exactly the potential issues were that might have been raised had an appeal been filed. Is that correct?
The record speaks for itself, Your Honor. Let me also say, I'm coming through the back door at that point. I can't really attack the merits of what happened. You know, I'm trying my best to find a way to get here, and you know, I did what I could, but definitely letting the statute run with some fumbling of the ball by the trial judge contributed to ineffective counsel.
In order to be ineffective, would you agree there has to be some showing of prejudice, you know, that there was a meritorious issue, or at least a potentially meritorious issue that was lost because of the attorney's failure to file the notice of appeal and reconsideration?
I would agree to that, but in as much as I'm coming much later down the road, I don't know how much leeway I would have to examine each and every fact, which again brings me back to my previous point where, you know, these counsel were standing there with all due respect to Justice Moon's comments, and there should have been cross-examination done to bring up more facts. The state has overwhelming record mainly because, you know, nobody questioned, nobody cross-examined. So.
Well, if someone doesn't perfect an appeal, and as Yoni Mori said, that she was ineffective, in effect, and that she really didn't have time to look at the record. She asked the court to appoint someone else in her place who was an expert in Rule 60 motions because she didn't really know what to do. In those circumstances, if someone fails to perfect an appeal at that point, have they really had the opportunity to raise or to review the record to come up with defenses?
I don't think so. Because if you don't have the full, you know, again, I come to the back door, but to appeal on the record itself, you know, you have an opportunity to go over each and every line by line what went wrong. So I think the word ineffective is ineffective. It's too late.
But counsel, you could certainly have talked to your client to ask her what in her view had been done. You could order transcripts. It's done all the time when people bring ineffective assistance of counsel claims in the criminal context. And I'm not saying this is a criminal context, but there certainly are ways in which even new counsel can learn enough about the facts of a case to be able to present an indication of what the potentially meritorious issues are.
I admit that's true.
But you're not here for ineffective assistance, are you, at this point? We're not talking about your status. We're talking about the ineffectiveness of Ms. Yoni Mori, who failed to timely file an appeal.
That's what I'm here for.
So if she failed to timely file an appeal, it's not even clear that she exercise any discretion or as to whether or not there was a basis for an appeal or a meritorious defense.
That's correct. That's correct.
So, Mr. Arezzo, assume everybody agrees she was ineffective. She missed the condition preceding to filing an appeal. Are they situations, and this goes to the violating of her due process rights?
Yes.
Right? Are there cases where there's been a violation of a constitutional right and yet it's harmless? Is this one of those cases?
Well, that's a tough question to answer. Well, to say there's a violation and it's harmless, I can't think of one case like that. To me, it's very harmful because it sets a precedence. And that's why the ICA is struggling to find a standard. To me, they're struggling to find a standard. What happens when there is ineffective assistance? In the court, ICA's case, they decide, well, maybe there was, but we're just going to let this ride and we're not going to grant a new trial. To me, to make things right, to keep justice blind, you have to give a new trial. I know it's encumbrance on the court and the lawyers also, but again, that's the life we choose. And we got to take the tough road and make sure everybody's rights are safeguarded. And that's why I'm here. And I think...
What did the ICA determine in this case? In regards to the meritorious defense. Going to whether or not, in my mind, it goes to whether or not this ineffective assistance of counsel violation was harmless.
Well, my reading of the court, and I'm far from the person to be speaking on behalf of the ICA, but I can see the court struggling, and to their credit, they know something. They're going to hold that this is akin to a criminal standard, ineffective assistance of counsel, but we're going to stop short of granting a new trial. And to me, I can't agree that if it's ineffective in a family court context where the relationship is forever gone, you must give a new trial. I think that's the only remedy there is. It's not easy to do, but it's too easy to sweep the case under the rug and move on to the next one. The stakes are too high. Because not only do you have the mother who wants the child, you have a daughter, a minor at that point, who's going to lose her natural-born mother. And not saying she's not having a good life, a wonderful life, that's beside the point for now. But that relationship is severed. And that's why I'm here. I'm trying to, you know, preserve that relationship.
How old is the child now?
How old? 8, 9?
In excess of 10?
10, excuse me.
Has she been adopted?
I cannot answer that.
The family court found that reunification with mother would be harmful to the child. Mother has had no contact with the child since March 12, 2004, at that time.
Yes.
Child has spent the vast majority of her life in foster care.
Yes. And
the question again,
yes,
is what Justice Akoba asked you. Opposition is indicating that there is no meritorious defense.
Well,
what do you have to say to that?
Well, I hope the child's doing great. I hope she's thriving in a foster care system. Any parent, any person would want that. And we have no access to that information, but we hope that she's doing well. At the same time, mother wants to know, let the daughter know that she fought for maintaining that relationship, which is one of the first things she told me when I took the case. You know, I wanted to know I did all I could to, you know, try to be a mother to her. And that, to me, that tears me up inside.
Mr. Araujo, yes. What you're asking for is not for a new trial in effect. If the ineffective assistance of counsel took place at the point of appeal, then wouldn't you be entitled to then an appeal analogous to criminal cases where an appeal is filed late, but there's no ineffective showing on the record at this point as to trial counsel?
Other than what I mentioned, they're standing there not cross-examining and basically being muted by you know what transpired. So,
can you be real specific on that? What do you mean by cross-examination?
Well, if you're on standby, you're literally standing next to the client. The client is trying to cross-examine these witnesses. You're just there to, you know, answer questions, or, you know, whatever she asks of you. You can, I guess, interject your opinion, but you're not allowed to stand up and actually cross-examine a witness. And I'm sure Your Honor is aware that that's the most vital part of any...
Are you saying that's what happened in this case? That
for the most part...
Your client was the one who was conducting the cross-examination?
I believe that's what happened.
Mr. Araujo, if I could ask, there are no transcripts that you've ordered for this appeal. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So we are speculating about what happened at the trial, and in fact, we're speculating about what happened at the hearing on the motion that you filed for a new trial, because we don't have a transcript from that in the record, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so we have a proceeding that's been going on for, by my understanding, a total of 8 years, in which there was a six-day trial, correct?
Yes.
And in essence, at the end of that, we have the motion that's brought us here today, or the appeal from which has brought us here today, which, would you agree, is it in effect a Rule 60B6 motion to set aside the trial?
Yes.
That's a motion that's, under our case law, directed to the sound discretion of the court, is it not?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So we're being asked to decide whether the court, which sat through all these proceedings, had the benefit of being present for 8 years of proceedings, abused its discretion in denying the motion, but we don't have a transcript to be able to independently assess whether it, in fact, utilized its discretion in a sound way or not. How do we get around that, or how can we get around
that? I would refer to the answering brief of DHS, page 28, where the department states who was present, the dates that standby counsel Alika Thone in this case was present. And the majority of the time, he's just standby with KIOPA, is standing there during the trial itself for numerous hearings in 2003, 2004. So I guess by implication or inference, which I hope is enough, she's just standing there and watching her client doing the work and trying her best to examine. And this is a woman with mental impairments.
Mr. Rachel, in terms of the passage of time, I mean, we wouldn't be here if there wasn't ineffective assistance of counsel, would we?
That's correct.
And wasn't a great deal of that time expended because of ineffective assistance of counsel?
Yes.
And so we had two appeals in this case, and both were, processed by counsel who was ineffective.
Yes.
So if we talk about delay, the delay was the cause of, came about because of the ineffective assistance of counsel.
That's correct. And again,
so would be ignoring that a cure for that kind of situation? I mean, well, assuming if everything went right, we wouldn't have this case. The only time we come up with a situation where ineffective assistance of counsel is presented is when there is ineffective assistance of counsel.
That's correct. And I don't know if the passage of time means that because so much time has passed, like Latches, you know, it's too late. I don't believe that because this is still a minor.
Well, especially in the case of ineffective assistance of counsel, we don't visit the prejudice on the client because it's not the client's fault. Isn't that true?
That's
the whole idea of ineffective assistance of counsel, at least in the criminal context.
Yes.
And we've said that, like in civil cases, you can at least sue your attorney for money, but in criminal cases, we're talking about the loss of liberty.
That's correct.
And so we don't hold it against the client.
No.
And at least the U.S. Supreme Court has said that the interest that a parent has in children is at least as important.
Maybe more in my book, Your Honor.
At least this court has indicated that it is important.
Yes, very important.
Counsel, in deciding a Rule 60B motion, would you agree, or in bringing one, would you agree that the move-on has to show some exceptional circumstances?
Yes.
And would you agree that it's a reasonable factor for the trial court to take into account whether the move-on has been able to establish some probability or likelihood of success on the merits?
I was there with the judge.
I'm sorry?
I was there with at that motion. He outlined his reasons. I was there. I admit that. So. But again, this is also the same judge that fumbled the football toward the end and, you know, actually denied a full-on appeal hearing by the reviewing courts. So,
where counsel is ineffective and never has filed an appeal, and we don't know whether or not counsel has examined the record for purposes of coming up with defenses, how fair is it then to cut off the right to counsel at that point.
I don't know if I can even answer that. How fair is it for the client, which is the one that's all I see, and the child, either have effective counsel or ineffective? If it's ineffective, then again, like the court has suggested or directed, the burden is placed upon the system, the lawyer. You know, this is, what are you going to do? She's not a lawyer. And like Judge Mendez told me, you don't have a lawyer, you lose. You know, that, and that's in a civil case. And this one is even higher stakes here. I don't have much more to say. I think that there is some argument. I wanted to see those records, which I can't see. And the ICA, well, if you can identify, which records it is, then, you know, maybe we'll let you see it, I guess. But I, since I can't see it, I can't identify it. So that's an aside issue.
Do you have the ability to look at any of the records?
Not since her rights were terminated. I did file a motion on that asking to see the records, but the judge declined, the trial judge declined.
Even the records?
Post order, yeah. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Howard Shiroma. I'm a Deputy Attorney General representing the Department of Human Services in this case. I've been with the AG's office now, going on 7 years. This case is older than me, Your Honor. CPS cases begin with the child and end with the child. Pursuant to the purpose and policy and purposes of 587-1, one of the key ones is where the court has determined by clear and convincing evidence that the child cannot be returned to a safe family home, the child will be permanently placed in a timely manner. At 2 years pursuant to statute, the court is obligated to set a permanent custody hearing. And the reason for that is that you want to permanently place children. Children that are in foster custody have already been harmed. Their lives are generally permanently altered by it, and their chances of success are greatly decreased the longer they're in foster custody. If the court is considering the equities, and I think that the court needs to consider the equities in the situation, the court must also consider the length of time the child has been in foster custody, which has been since 2002, I believe.
Did the state raise that in its response to the application?
I believe I did put in a response, the time that the
Rule
child...
Rule 60?
To the Rule 60. I believe it was in my opposition to the Rule 60s as well, Your Honor.
Was Rule 60 listed in your response to the application for certiorari?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
You did not argue it, did you?
No, Your Honor.
You didn't argue the timeliness of the Rule 60 motion?
I are not in the opposition to the writ, no, Your Honor.
You did not argue prejudice to the child?
No, Your Honor. The fact that the child has spent the majority of her life with the current custodian, the fact that the child is now 10 years of age, the fact that the child has not lived the last 7 years in foster custody, the child is 10. The child will be 18 in 8 years.
And to what do you attribute this delay in resolution of this case?
I think the delay in resolution of this case, well, first of all, I'd like to point out that through trial, this case is okay. Post-trial, I think, is where the problems arise, Your Honors. I think that probably Carione Mori, for whatever reason, and that's part of the problem, is we don't know why she did not take the appeal. I don't know what took place between mother and Ms. Yone Mori. It's the reason is that an appeal wasn't properly timely taken. A motion for recon needed to be filed. That was not done. The court dismissed this case for lack of jurisdiction.
They filed two affidavits that said none of it was the fault of the petitioner.
Right. It was stated.
Do you have anything to rebut that?
Well, it's hard to rebut something when it's done in a general conclusory manner without specifying exactly the reasons why something was not done.
You had hearings, right? So you could have done something about that, couldn't you?
I could have asked, but the problem is there were never any answers. There were never any answers to the court. That's what the trial court struggled with. That's what the ICA struggled with. If Ms. Yone Mori is saying I'm ineffective, you would probably like to lay out the details as to time and places when communications were not made, positions of the client, when and where what they were at certain times. Frankly, I do not know why Ms. Yone Mori did not file. We do not know. Was it tactical? I don't know. I could have asked way
before. You accept the fact that that's ineffective assistance of counsel?
I'm not conceding that point, Your Honor, because I do not know.
File is not ineffective?
If in hindsight we're assuming that it was not a volitional act, yes.
You think it's a volitional act of the mother that she asked that appeal not be filed?
No, but there are lots of CPS cases where the clients do not take an appeal. If we do not know what was discussed, what was said, I cannot take a position on it, Your Honor.
But in this case, the mother indicated she wanted to take an appeal.
Well, I presume by the Rule 60 motion, some 1 year after the TPR, termination of parental rights, that's an indication, although lots of parents have, you know, they have their second thoughts about it.
She filed her Rule 60 motion in 04. September 04.
That would have been to some other issue, Your Honor. It wasn't as to the termination of parental rights. Parental rights were terminated in 3/11/05. Mother filed numerous motions on her own.
Yeah, you're correct. Did she file a request for, did she raise the question of ineffective assistance of counsel?
She raised it, I guess, by saying she wanted her counsel discharged and new counsel appointed or to proceed on her own throughout the case, Your Honor.
So she did file a request for appointment of counsel?
She may have filed it written or made oral requests of the court at many times.
Counsel, is there anything in the record to explain why the family court, when it issued its findings of fact and conclusions of law, in March of 05, and in that order, terminated Ms. Ioppa, the prior standby counsel, and directed the mother in this case to immediately file a request for new counsel. Is there anything in the record to explain why the court took that action, what factors it was taking into account?
Well, unlike the general policy in the Third Circuit, is as it is in the First, is that generally trial counsel would continue to preserve a parent's appeal if they wanted one. However, in this particular case, I believe at one of the trials, if not, it was either at a hearing or at the trial itself, mother made representations that she was going to become financially able to secure her own counsel. I think at that point, the court, in reliance upon that, entered the order that it did in the findings, Your Honor.
But we don't have a transcript that establishes that, correct?
No, Your Honor. And now, in hindsight, looking back, I wish I had ordered all of the trial transcripts when counsel for the appellant did not do so, because I think the case would be strengthened by having obtained them. But however, it's not our policy to obtain full trial transcripts if the appellant does not request them. Generally, it's always as a reactionary thing. We get those transcripts if the appellant requests them. And also, I felt that with the record on appeal as it was standing, with the findings of fact and conclusions of law, that I had sufficient factual evidence to support our case.
But you could have requested transcripts.
Oh, yes, certainly, Your Honor.
Figure it up one way or the other.
I could have one way or the other, Your Honor. I felt I did not.
So in this case, the court at least knew that, and I guess the court on its own discharge, I don't know if it's Ms. or Mr. Ioppa. Is that correct?
I beg your pardon?
The court on its own discharged Ioppa, the standby counsel.
Yes, based on mother's representations, yes.
Do you have something in the transcript that indicates that that was the basis for discharge of Ioppa?
There is nothing other than the findings of fact, conclusions of law, Your Honor.
What about in the transcript?
I presume there should be something in the transcript.
Do you have a transcript?
No, Your Honor. Transcripts were not ordered.
So as to the discharge, the court knew, in fact, it made a finding that mother suffers from a mental health condition that distorts her perceptions of people and this causes her to come into conflict with and to refuse to cooperate with people that are trying to help her. So the court knew that was the situation and the status mother was in when the court discharged counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
And could the court have simply kept counsel on until new counsel came in?
It's yes, the court certainly could have done that as well, Your Honor. But I'd like to point out, if the court reviews the record carefully, the court was extremely careful in addressing and providing counsel to mother. In her first counsel, when mother said, "I don't want Miss Lynette anymore," the court discharged her. Now, with Mr. Alika Thone, the court, and I want to say that through trial, representation was seamless. Mother had counsel at all times. Contrary to what the justices might think, standby counsel does not mean the counsel sits there and says nothing. And that's one of the reasons I regret not having gotten the transcripts. There was full cross-examination.
You can't make the representation one way or the other.
That what?
You can't make the representation one way or the other that standby counsel just stood by.
Yeah, they did not just stand.
Because you didn't order a transcript either.
That's correct, Your Honor.
There is something in the record filed by the petitioner in this case that she wasn't being helped by standby counsel. I guess it was IOPA or whatever. Because the counsel said that it wasn't the counsel's duty to subpoena witnesses or to look for witnesses. You recall that?
I don't recall that, Your Honor, off the top.
Okay. If that's the case, then would she have had effective counsel or effective help of counsel?
With respect to that.
Okay. If you look at the motion for dismissal of counsel and continuance filed on September 17th, 04, she has a statement saying in 3, assigned counsel K. IOPA has told me repeatedly since July 29, 2004 that, quote, it is beyond my scope of duties as standby counsel, quote, to help locate, contact, or interview witnesses. So if that's the case, was Ms. IOPA, or Mr. IOPA, I don't know, effective in terms of allowing or helping Ms. Britton, considering the fact that she was in a particular mental state that the court found she was in?
Yeah, in that particular instance, I do not know why Ms. IOPA might not have refused to subpoena certain witnesses. I would, you know, maybe in her own mind as an attorney for mother, decided that these are not witnesses that would help their case. But with respect to mother's mental
and this
health.
This was filed during the pendency of the trial. The trial took place, the permanent commitment or custody trial, took place from August 23rd to December 13th, 04.
Right, but ultimately the final decision on how best to present a case should be the attorney's, Your Honor. I don't think Ms. IOPA or any attorney is going to, should act on and do everything a client requests. It's not everything, Your Honor, but I don't know what was in Ms. Kayopa's mind and her representation.
Are you seriously arguing that there was not ineffective assistance of counsel in this case?
No, I'm not arguing that there wasn't, Your Honor. Part of my problem is I do not know what transpired in the private conversations or communications between mother and Ms. Yonemori. I would say on its face it appears like there was ineffective assistance, because if mother truly, in hindsight, wanted to appeal, then yes, the one was not taken.
In your response, you never indicated that there was not ineffective assistance of counsel in terms of not filing the appeal on time.
No. But I want to go back to one point. In the representations in the court's appointment of counsels, Alika Thone was appointed for mother. And at one point, Ms. Bitten, or the mother, I'm sorry, said that she wanted new counsel. The court, instead of simply discharging him, modified it and placed him as standby counsel for a period of time. When Ms. IOPA came on, she was standby counsel. So what I'm saying is that the court did not willy-nilly say you have an attorney, you don't have an attorney. The court looked at the facts at the time that mother was making these requests and gave her the counsel that they thought was most appropriate at that particular time. So, and Ms. Mother in this particular case never had a GAL. Mother, if you look at the psych evals, is an average intelligence. there was no arguments that, you know, she was able to understand and comprehend things. She was able to come to points where she said, I don't want this attorney, or I will work with this attorney as standby counsel. So, you know, I think it's unfair to say that because mother has a mental health issue, then the court should have maintained counsel throughout at all times. The court, I think, was quite sensitive to mother's needs, actually, in adjusting her counsel situation. I do believe that the ICA's decision needs to be upheld, Your Honor, because I don't think there was any error that were prejudicial. And I mean, I don't think mother could present a meritorious defense. I think the state of the law in Hawaii is not the Strickland standard. The Strickland standard is actually, I think, a more difficult standard, which is why the court in Hawaii has decided not to use it. Essentially, Strickland would say ineffective assistance of counsel consists of error by counsel that was professionally unreasonable, and but for that error, the result or verdict would have been different. The court chose not to use that. The court in State v. Antone stated that the counsel failed to establish specific errors or omissions of defense counsel, reflecting counsel's lack of skill, judgment, or diligence, and these errors or omissions result in either the withdrawal or impairment of a potentially meritorious defense. My strength, Your Honor, lies in that and the equities of the case. When counsels, they've now had, this is a third chance at it. They've had two prior chances at it, I think. The Supreme Court, two of them were to the Supreme Court. This one went through the ICA first. Is that?
Well, excuse me, counsel.
Yeah.
The two prior chances were as a result of ineffective assistance, right? The first one was dismissed because a motion for reconsideration wasn't filed.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that is the ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Yes, but let's take it even one step further back, I mean, to the Rule 60B motions, Your Honor. Instead of asserting simply ineffective assistance, Your Honor, why not assert your appeal case? If you look at my answer to the Rule 60B appeals, I essentially stuck in a response to a full-on appeal in addition to addressing the ineffective assistance and addressing the lack of access to confidential records issues. I put in what I needed to put in for an appeal. My question is, in a Rule 60, if you know that you've not taken an appeal timely in addressing the ineffective assistance and lack of access, why not put on your appeal case, Your Honor, so that the court can fully address everything? Another thing, too, is that whatever records on appeal I had, mother had through time of trial. That's why this thing about access to records in September of 06 or subsequent is sort of it's a red herring, Your Honor. Those records are not relevant to anything that occurred pre-termination. Whatever I had, they had pre-termination. I think Mr. Urejo even said that. Anything up to the time of that last day of trial, they had.
The Rule 60 motion filed by Ms. Yonemori was coupled with her request to withdraw, wasn't it?
Right.
Because she felt she was ineffective.
Yes.
She in fact said she was ineffective. That's
right.
Why she wanted to withdraw
right.
from the case. So there's no indication that she made any review of the record to try to raise defenses.
Right. Why?
So her whole purpose of filing the Rule 60 was to say, I guess Ms. Britton didn't have effective counsel, she was the one who was ineffective, and therefore she should be allowed to withdraw.
I think that was the crux of her motions.
So under those circumstances, why would she raise these defenses on the Rule 60?
Why she
out of the case?
Right, but why she wouldn't, I don't know. Why she waited 1 year or more than 1 year from the judgment on the termination, I don't know, Your Honor.
Well, she did give reasons, but in her declaration. But isn't that another sign of ineffectiveness?
I think it could be used to support another ineffective assistance. But the question is, looking at the record, which I believe both sides had, which I essentially presented on my answering brief to the original appeal, the court had sufficient evidence to say, one, there were no facts that would support mother's case, and there were ample or sufficient evidence to support the DHS position that mother's rights would be terminated. Thus, the second prong of the state's test in State v. Anton would not have been met by mother.
Counsel, in assessing the Rule 60 motion as an appropriate for the family court to take into consideration the interests of the child, and in particular, the child's interest in finality and knowing whether he or she will be or can be adopted, and if so, was that done in this case and done in an appropriate manner?
I think the answer to that is a resounding yes, Your Honor. In Hayashi v. Hayashi, 4 Hawaii App 286, 1983, it states, equity will not grant relief for situations for movement's own fault, neglect, inadvertence, or carelessness. In Nakata v. Nakata, 3 Hawaii App 51, 1982, Rule 60B should be used only where the relief will further justice without affecting the substantial rights of the parties. So I think that answers your question, Your Honor, and that's why I started my oral argument with equity.
Well, Hayashi has nothing to do with a constitutional right to effective assistance of counsel, did it?
No, Your Honor.
Hayashi was what, divorce case?
Yeah.
Well, counsel, is there anything in the record indicating what was happening to this child while this case was pending in terms of her status, in terms of how she viewed the world, in terms of uncertainty, and the effect of uncertainty of this case upon her? And again, are those, first of all, is that in the record? And secondly, are those
that would be in the record,
legitimate considerations to take into account in deciding a Rule 60B motion in this context?
That would be in the record, Your Honor. If the court, it would be in the record, not directly from the child, but likely through people such as a child's therapist, a child psychologist, a DHS social worker. The child does not speak in court hearings.
Right. And what does that information show, counsel? Do you know?
I think the information would show that the child was seriously psychologically, emotionally harmed by living with mother, that the child improved when she was not with mother or had no contact with mother. And these would be in the Safe Family Home reports primarily, but there would be reports from psychologists as well as other therapists, Your Honors. And that should be in the record, which the court has.
And belabor the point, but all these findings, whatever happened at trial, that is all at this point uncontested because mother has never had the chance to present her side of the case, at least on appeal. Isn't that true?
Well, I'd like to couch that with a couch to yes, Your Honor. Mother also never objected. Ms. Iopa, trial counsel, never objected to the findings of fact, conclusions of law that were drafted by Judge Gaddis. So,
yeah, but on the in the findings of fact and conclusions of law itself, at that point, in the findings itself, not afterwards, during a separate order, the court discharged as part of its findings Ms. Iopa. Isn't that true?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
So upon the entry of the findings of fact and conclusions of law, Ms. Britton had no counsel.
I would say that's correct, Your Honor. I don't think that there should be an issue with respect to as to whether mother was represented by counsel fairly and fully through trial. The use of standby counsel in this case was due to mother's multiple rejection of various counselors. Still, the court kept adjusting that representation procedure. This thing with access to records troubles me. If the court is going to touch that in any case, one of the reasons why the court, after termination of parental rights, can preclude parents from participating in the proceedings is because a lot of times parents will interfere, harass, or even stalk foster parents and the children. So if there's going to be some sort of ruling that permits access, I hope it's not unfettered, and there should be some limitations on that.
Mr. Shiroma, do you agree that under the Hawaii Constitution, indigent persons whose rights will be or are set alleged right for termination should have the right to counsel?
Yes.
Okay. And so how does that right not be applied in this case?
Well, mother had counsel, although I guess in hindsight she was ineffective counsel. There has been a lot of delay The case is troublesome because of the delays in the case. If Ms. Yonemori felt that she was ineffective shortly after the time deadline for the motion for recon passed, I think that action should have been taken. But again, the action and the resulting prejudice should not fall on the child or the Department of Human Services. Through trial, the department did what it needed to do, Your Honor. The problem.
Well, I think you know you raise a relevant issue, but before we get to that point, should Ms. Britton have the right of process at least to present her side of the case? And so, the status of the child is at least one factor to be weighed. But at this point, how can we say that weighing that factor is fair when we're hearing only from one side?
You know, Your Honor, I've wrestled with that problem, but I think my conclusion, and not just because of the equities, or it is partly due to the equities, is that my answer would be no, Your Honor. I think that a party should have a right to a fair hearing opportunity, in this case an appeal. However, in terms of the equities, I think on balance, it tips the scale over to the fact that based upon the record that the court currently has, that I had, that the appellant had, and the delay in time, in this one, the answer is no.
Well, I see your point, but I think equities is a conclusion. How you come out on that is a conclusion that you come to after you're looking at both sides. And it's difficult to me to believe that we can come out with an equitable decision when we are faced only with one side. And I think that really was the basis for the Supreme Court's decision in Lassiter, because it recognized that there was, I think, an unhealthy unequalness between the two sides when indigent people are not represented by counsel.
Yes, but Lassiter did not have the case, I don't think, is distinguishable because there were multiple representations in this case due a lot in part to mother and the court's efforts to provide her counsel that was effective during the case, Your Honor. And I think for that reason it can be distinguished, actually. Mother was very difficult throughout the case. The court and others accommodate her quite a lot, actually.
Well, counsel, would you agree with counsel for the mother that, in the end, coming back to what we're actually reviewing here, it was a Rule 60B6 motion, correct?
Yes.
That we review for an abuse of discretion. Is that correct as well?
Yes.
And our settled law in Hawaii is that there are a variety of factors that should be taken into account and weighed by the court in reaching that decision. Is that also your understanding?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And is it your understanding that the court considered the merits or the lack of showing of any meritorious issues by the by the mother in this case in reaching its ruling? Or not? Or is that even in the record?
I think it is in the record, Your Honor. In my answering brief, I think I addressed that based upon a record on appeal available to both sides. And I'm asking the court to consider that record. The court had the full record of every transcript of every hearing and trial in this matter? No. I think there is sufficient or ample evidence without it. I think the court should consider it. One other thing, Your Honor, that troubled me throughout this case is that essentially we have an appellate process set up. I know ineffective assistance in hindsight might have sort of prevented that in this case. But essentially, if you're going to permit Rule 60Bs to be filed 364 days after a judgment or order, over 365 days and 2 years, which essentially, if the process goes its full course, is going to end up with, yes, maybe there was ineffective assistance, and we're going to give this person another appeal, then the appeal process that is currently set up is ineffective itself, Your Honors.
In fact, would there be anything to preclude mother if we went the way she suggests in this case from bringing, if we were to rule against her in this case, is there anything to preclude her from bringing an ineffective assistance of counsel claim against her current counsel?
No, Your Honor, there isn't. And that is very troublesome, actually. But that's why I ask, look at the record that you do have with the multiple representations. A lot of this is not due in part to the court or counsel themselves, it's due to mother. At some point after 4 or 5 representations, I think people need to look at, is the problem the attorneys or the client?
And let me make clear, I'm not in any way commenting on Mr. Rejo's representation. I'm simply asking in the abstract whether that would be open to mother, and your answer is yes.
under her version of the law?
Yes.
Well, the answer to that is that once an indigent person is before the court, it should not go unrepresented, or that person should not go unrepresented. Isn't that true?
You still have to look at it on a fact-by-fact cases, Your Honor.
33 states reject this case-by-case analysis.
Yes, I would say that generally the answer to that question should be yes, but, you know, I can't say if mother has some mental health issues that might preclude her from even having an attorney in some circumstances.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Any more time for Mr. Arizo? Mr. Arizo.
Say, I'm more listening to the discussion. Fascinating.
Now, Mr. Arizo, the state did not raise Rule 60 in its response to your application.
Yes.
Is that true? And the ICA apparently assumed that whatever time was required under Rule 60 was satisfied, because it said, despite the argument of the state with respect to Rule 60, we decide the merits of the claim for ineffective assistance of counsel.
That's what I read. one final point, the motion for reconsideration, which could have brought up different points, that was also not filed on time, so that, you know, that was swept and is gone forever. So I think when you talk about equities, you know, realizing that time has passed and this situation develops, and it may even be an unpopular decision, but it's too easy to just sweep this case under the rug, because we're going to have more and more cases like this, difficult to handle clients, and I think, if anything, the trial judges have to be right on the ball and make sure that if they're going to discharge counsel, that the appeal period doesn't simply run on its own. And
in fact, if we say this case is okay, there's no imperative on the family courts to appoint counsel or to see that counsel is present for indigent defendants throughout the case.
Well, they should always be present, and the court has to be very careful when it does discharge an attorney. It's not at a critical period where within the time when a motion for reconsideration could still be filed, and the appeal also could still be filed on time.
You're saying this can apply again in the future if we don't establish a rule?
That's what I'm saying. That's what the ICA is suggesting. They seem to be struggling with, you know, some kind of guidance by the system. You know, there's a breach, ineffective assistance of counsel. The remedy is where I disagree with. My remedy is new trial. Unfortunately, that's how it works. Otherwise, there's no teeth in the law.
What about new appeal?
New appeals, okay, halfway there, but new trial is always better. Things change, you know. New counsel appointed and new facts come out, you know. She's been living in the same home now for years, and, you know, age sometimes does wonders for people. So, as far as the child, the finality, you know, I sympathize with the child, very much so, but the child is still entitled to know she has a mother, and should there be reunification, it's not just going to happen overnight. It takes years to unwind and reestablish family. So I think the professionals can handle that. Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Thank you to both counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement.